This is one you can't sing softly. At least you just got to sing it out, and it speaks to your soul, does it not? All right. First, Matthew chapter 5, we will have to finish up from last week as we were dealing with21 through 26 on anger. Didn't quite finish that, and probably won't get finished today with this subject of lust and adultery, but that's okay. We'll catch up at some point. Let me just review some of what we looked at last week. We saw that Jesus taught with hyperbole and antithesis. In other words, overstatements, sometimes to emphasize a point. Sometimes, and I find this true in my own preaching, I'll preach on a subject and someone will run up after the service and, well, what about this? You didn't mention that and this. And of course, the point is I can't always do it. I can't always mention everything all the time. And so sometimes we're going to focus on this today, right? And so sometimes Jesus focuses on one thing, and that's why we have 66 books of the Bible to kind of balance those things out. But in the kingdom of God, it is not enough to murder someone, but we are to love and do good to others. And we are to guard our hearts that we want to love and not merely make an outward show. That's one of the things we're seeing here, that Jesus isn't just giving us a new law, a new set of laws to follow. He is showing us what true godliness is. Because our pursuit is not to just obey laws. Our pursuit is to be like Christ. And so if my heart and my mind begin to think like God, to be in tune with God, and we think like Christ, we will find ourselves obeying the Lord, doing what is right. So we focus on Christ. We focus on being conformed to His way of thinking. And that's what Jesus is doing us. He's given us your heart has to be in this scene. It has to be right before any actions you do mean anything. We also saw that not all anger is sinful. And we are either angry because sin has occurred, and we're angry because God's name has been besmirched, for instance, or our feelings have been hurt, and we're angry because of our own selfishness. And that's usually one way to kind of understand whether my anger is justified or not. So again, some of the things that we looked at last week. And so we kind of left off in verse 22. Where Jesus talks about how that if I say to you, anyone who is angry with your brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. Whoever says you fool will be liable for the hell fire. All the different kind of judgments, councils of man, as well as a judgment of God, showing that anger has the same is to be seen as a sin, just like murder is, with the same end. Because any sin brings you under the judgment of God. But all anger does, it leads us into a general disregard for others. It's a result of a general disregard for others. As we disregard their needs and their feelings, and we have a contempt in which you would treat somebody inferior to you, because at the heart of it all is a selfishness. You have no regard for God's honor, no regard for somebody else. Your feelings have been hurt. All you're thinking about is yourself, and anger will always arise from that. This should help us see, though, why some anger can be godly anger and how to determine the difference, as we've kind of already pointed out. When we sin in anger, it is always because our ego is wrapped up around the problem. When Jesus was angry, if you think about this, one of the few times you see him obviously angry, well, twice he was in his father's house. He was at the temple, and it was being abused. It was becoming a place to make money, but not a place to worship the Lord, and that makes him angry. So it wasn't a selfish reason. It was because the Lord, his father, was being dishonored. And it's proven again when we see Jesus being arrested and mistreated and crucified, all unjustly. If his ego was what the driving motivation behind him was, He would have called down the 10,000 angels and made it put a stop to it, if that's all that mattered. And when we walk through life, and really all that matters is how I feel right now, and you better make sure that you say just the right thing to me or look out, you got a problem. But Jesus was there to willingly to be abused by man for our salvation. In fact, second or First Peter brings this out, 2:22. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile and return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. The Lord sees things done to you, and when you're treated wrongly, you can get upset about it and be angry and you know, accomplish nothing for the Lord. But it's not gonna do any good. But when we say, you know what, I'll commit this to the Lord, He'll take care of these things, the Lord will work it all out. Nobody's getting by with anything, and that includes our sorry sinful selves, then we can let things go, right? And so every action and every thought for Christ was ruled by how he could honor the Father, not through his own will, certainly not through his own will apart from the Father. And all this shows just how little we can be angry without sinning, and should give us cause to think about things before we act and speak. We got to be very careful about saying, well, not all anger is sinful, as if somehow that excuses a lot of the way we are angry. It's rare that we can be angry. And I think we can be angry out when we see things going on in society and the world that is ungodly, that is unfair. Yes, we should be angry. But when it's our own personal relationships, very seldom is our anger justified in those situations. So we have to be very careful there. He forbids not all anger, but that really arises out of personal relationships. You know, if you think about it, would there be any murder, or for that matter, any outward actions against each other if we did not first sin in our hearts? And of course we know it. No, of course not. So think about what he is saying here and how it would affect our lives and our hearts if we had hearts like Christ. There would just not be relational problems. Now, of course, we're still in the flesh. That's our whole problem. But you see how this is getting at the heart of the matter. You think about the verse we've quoted from here recently, but the first part in particular, James is writing to the church and he says, what causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? See, you can't control your own passions, and that's why you can't get along with other people. So you desire and do not have, so you murder, you covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. I don't think that James is saying that there was a murder problem in the church. I don't think they were literally killing each other. I think he's probably drawing off of our text. He's saying that when you act like this, when you can't get along with people because your will's not being done and your selfishness, you are committing murder, because Jesus has told us that in Matthew chapter 5. Of course, it wasn't Matthew chapter 5 back then, but you know what I'm saying. So again, I think we see what's going on here. When in our hearts our goal is to honor the Lord in everything and to love others as we have been loved, then there will never be a harsh, mean-spirited word spoken, which shows you just how far from glory we are. There will never be hateful words or selfish actions that would escape our mouths or our hands. Our families and our churches and society would be immediately transformed, and it's not because we have a law against anger. Obviously, it is. But that's not really the problem here. It's not that we need a law against such things or a threat of punishment over us. It is because as people who have been saved and given new natures, we're no longer murderers. We're no longer people who are consumed with selfishness, and so we're no longer haters. We're no longer angry in that sense. Now, again, I'm talking about in an ideal way. We're not there yet, but we see where the process has begun. There's a sense in now, because I love the Lord, because of His grace shown to me, I am not a murderer. I don't murder people because of what Christ has done for me. I don't need to be a law out in the land here or in the Bible as far as that goes. Thou shalt not murder. I don't want to murder people. Now, sometimes, you know, you get angry, you know. But you see what I'm saying? It's because God, Christ has changed me, but I know I'm far from where I need to be. Because again, we committing murder in our hearts is something I haven't overcome by any stretch. But we're lovers of God now. And that's the only answer to all of our social problems. And it's the only way that we can do good and please the Lord, to have hearts that are changed. So right now we're in the kind of middle state where we need that direction, we need those laws. We've been changed. The law of God has been written on our hearts, but we still battle those things. But the day is coming when all sin is removed, and we won't, in heaven, we won't need a law because we will be righteous. And as 1 Timothy says, the law is for lawbreakers. We will be righteous. Our hearts will be right. In verse 24 then, once all this is in place, reconciliation becomes part of our duty before the Lord. If you think about it, just it only follows, leave your gift. He says if you're going to make an altar, a gift at the altar, and you remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift, go and at the altar, go and be reconciled with your brother first so that the Lord will accept your gift. So now we see reconciliation coming into all this because we are concerned with our testimony, and we're concerned. We now are people who want to love and do good and to be helpful and to minister to people. And if there is problems, that is can't be done or it's greatly hindered. So we are the people who are to seek reconciliation. Again, I think it's just kind of common sense in that sense. I think it kind of points back to the passage that says we are not our own, but we're bought with a price. So therefore glorify God in your body. I no longer am happy and satisfied and content if I know people are at odds with me for something that at least I can do something about. And of course we don't like accountability. You know, you read this and you think, man, you know, I don't, it's hard to do. We don't like to be accountable to others or feel responsible for others. And that's why a lot of people don't join churches, because you cannot live in the kingdom of God and see no duty between those who are around you, because our being holy is something that is worked out in relationships with people and accountability. And it is not okay for me to be at odds with somebody else if I can do anything about it, because it undoes everything that we're doing. And so if you throw money in the plate while all along you hate and you despise and you ignore others, you're not doing anything for the Lord. You're dishonoring the Lord. You're asking God to forgive you while you refuse to forgive somebody else. And notice here, he doesn't say that if you have something against someone else, but if you know they have something against you, go. Do everything you can to settle things before you claim to worship the Lord. Do your best. You know, and again, it doesn't mean that every time you go to church, you have to call up everybody again and try to make it out to make up with them. But you do it. Make that attempt. And then it's not your problem anymore in that sense. So true worship is not enhanced then by better music and prayers and the architecture around us, and even to some degree preaching, whether it's good or not. True worship is enhanced by hearts that love God above all else. It starts there. All the other stuff won't have any effect. I said, even the preaching, because if your heart's not right with God, then how can it? Unless God would take it and use it in your life. And so, Psalm 66 here says, if I had cherished iniquity in my heart, the Lord would not have listened. And so a lot of what goes on in churches is for our approval and for our enjoyment, and it allows us to be distracted so that we really don't care whether God is pleased with what we're doing, because we didn't really come there to hear from God and to let that light shine in my heart and see if I'm reflecting that glory of God. We're here to enjoy the music and to fellowship with people and to make a show or to do whatever. Then we're not worshiping God. We're playing church, but we're not actually going there for the right reason. And many people go to church judging the music, the liturgy, the message, and so forth, but they don't come primarily to be exposed by the Word of God. And when we get into that trap, and it doesn't mean that all those other things are bad necessarily. I mean, every church has liturgy. Might not call it that, but every church has a process by which they conduct the services, right, and the things that they do. But if all that is to be a process of worshiping God and not just making a show. So these attitudes that we hold on to with such fierceness sometimes makes us just as deserving of death as Charles Manson. Now, there's maybe a lot of young people here who have no idea who I just talked about. And so ask, look it up, Google it, not now, but later. In other words, Jesus is saying that, you know, we love to look down on bad, bad people, but you're committing sin in your heart just by your attitude towards people. And it's the same type of sin. You haven't acted it out physically, but you have acted it out mentally. You have shown no love to that person. Your anger affects you to the point that you won't love them as you could or as you should. You won't talk to them or you won't talk to them in the same way. It affects you. And it's the same type of sin. And that's the thing. What he's doing here is exposing our murderous hearts. And so he finishes at 25 and 26 as he illustrates the necessity of immediate action and the impossibility of living peacefully together if we don't learn how to love even as we have been loved. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you are going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard and put you in prison. That's kind of a practical, you know, example of what he's saying. But truly, truly, I say to you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny. In other words, your anger and your refusal to admit wrong or to ask for forgiveness or to make things right is going to result in things worse. Now, it might not be this. You know, you might not be a matter of where you owe somebody you end up in jail, whatever. But it's going to be worse. In other words, if you don't take care of the little problems and the little spats that we sometimes have, because Christ is controlling everything, it just grows and grows until eventually you don't talk to somebody anymore. You leave the church, or the church splits, or the family has problems, whatever. You have a problem with your brother and sister. It just gets worse and worse. Christ says that shows a heart that doesn't care about the Lord. Quickly go. When you see a problem, take care of it. Or at least do your best to take care of it. Because if you love the Lord with all your heart, mind, body, and soul, that is what you do. It's hard. Very hard. But who do we love the most? And so in one verse, Jesus destroys all the pretense of self-righteousness. And he's really just beginning here. Any thoughts that we aren't as bad as we think we are, any thoughts that we're not as bad as what Jesus here seems to be suggesting is ridiculous. John MacArthur tells the story of a man called Two Gun Crowley, who was a gunslinger back in the 1800s, who he was a gunslinger. He died in a gun battle with somebody with the law. And as they search in his body, they pull out a note that he had written there that he had in his coat pocket that says, "Under my coat is a weary heart, a kind one, one that would do nobody harm." And yet he was a murderer. He had killed many people. But he had deceived himself into thinking that he's okay. And we got to be careful here, because we got to be careful about saying, well, these sins are really bad, but you know, these sins aren't so bad. Because Jesus says, no, sin is sin. And we need to take it seriously. And no doubt these Jews had to be reeling at this point. But if we're listening to this, we should be reeling. I'm reeling. I realize that then he's pointing to me. And I know people. I've met people who think you can become sinless. And what self-deception. Because Jesus uncovers our sin problems, does he not? And so as we get to the next verse 27 here, where he starts to deal with lust and adultery, it doesn't get any easier. As Jesus exposed the prevalence of sin in us, he has addressed the worst form of hatred and that we can commit towards somebody else. It says that is murder, but at the same time shown that hatred and despising others is the same kind of sin before God and deserving of the same punishment. In other words, death in hell, eternal separation from God. And now he turns his attention to another form. Again, notice the connection here. Because sin is sin, lust and adultery is another form of acting out hatred towards somebody. Of hurting somebody. We don't like to think of it that way, but that's what it is. What we find again is that with Jesus, the offense against the letter of the law is only a byproduct of a sin that has already been committed in one's heart. And that's why if you don't take care of the heart problem, you don't have a chance. Now let's be clear when we talk about, let's talk about lust for a little while. Today our society doesn't see lust, even adultery, as a sin, let alone lust, right? Certainly not as a very serious offense. But this is because they don't see marriage as holy, as a holy institution, but that one's self-sufficient, self-fulfillment and satisfaction trumps everyone and everything else. And they think that if it's going on in my mind, it's nobody else's business. Well, there are a couple of things wrong with that. First of all, it's God's business because he gave you that mind. It is to be used a certain way. But it also, because lust is, as James 1 tells us, lust and not just lust, but bad thinking, because lust isn't just got sexual kind of tones. You can lust or covet about anything, right? So what's going on in your mind is God's business because it leads to sin. And it leads to all these things he's talking about. But the society, of course, doesn't think anybody knows what's going on in his mind. And they don't see the need to focus one's love on one person only because life to them is all about what makes me happy. That's why when my partner doesn't make me happy anymore, I move on to another one. And so you don't take marriage seriously if that's your mindset, that I'm all that matters. Never mind what happens to a society where the family becomes weak and ineffective, which is another result, of course, of lust and adultery. So it's not hard to see why anger and lust are the first two things Jesus addresses. For in these two things, so many human ills have arisen, and they are prime examples of just how sinful we are, right? I mean, we all can relate to these things. You know, very easily. We might add that Jesus is also attacking the moral standards of the Jewish leaders. I'll talk about this in a moment, but his subject here is adultery because he's going to, as we see in a couple of weeks, he's really talking about the sin of adultery and these in the view of marriage that the Jewish leaders have. But as he does that, he brings up things that we can find other application as well. He's right now, though, kind of veiling his attack on the Jewish leaders until the time where he is crucified. So I'll give you an example. Right now, he has just gone through the Beatitudes. Blessed are those who do this, and blessed are those who have that kind of mindset. And the Pharisees can hear that and think, well, you know, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm pretty good. I can agree with all that. But of course they can't. But right now is not his time to be crucified. He's still got 3 years or so before that happens. So he is very veiled in his attack towards the Pharisees and the Sadducees and so forth. The week before he's crucified, when we get to Matthew chapter 23, it's now time for them to be crucified. He understands that. So he kind of pulls away the curtain and he makes it very clear what he thinks about them. And so what do you have in Matthew 23? Woe to you Pharisees. And he starts talking about many of these things that said, you're not blessed, you're cursed, because woe is to pronounce a curse upon you. And so he says there, like in Matthew 23, he says, you love the chief places. You love to be called by the chief titles. You're the very opposite of those who were described in the Beatitudes. And he kind of uncovers it. You're going to receive the worst woe. And so that kind of gives you an idea of how his language will change somewhat concerning them. But here, he's keeping things at a low roar, you might say, and not letting the cat out of the bag entirely. But when Jesus talks about murder, the scribes and the Pharisees are saying to themselves, well, we're on safe ground here. You know, we haven't murdered anybody. Well, let's face it. When you look at this and you see that thou shalt not murder in Exodus 23, even we feel a little sense of relief, right? Because, well, at least that one I'm okay on. And Jesus has already shown you, well, no, that's not really the case. Because Jesus says, if you hate your brother, then he will judge you in the same way he would a murderer in that sense as well. So we will see this very clearly when it comes to adultery, which we'll tackle in a couple of weeks. So if these two sins alone can be mastered, that is hatred and lust, not only would society fundamentally change overnight, but more importantly, Christians who now have the power to have some measure of control over their emotions and thought life can then live a life that is not controlled by the flesh, but by the Spirit. In other words, just think of the ramifications in our own life if lust and hatred and our emotions and our feelings can be under control as they should be. I mean, look out at the world. You can watch videos of people showing, you know, video of them emoting, of being able to control their emotions and their feelings and completely unable to think straight because they're ruled by their emotions. And so I believe Jesus has given us a key to fighting sin by teaching us that the battle against sin begins in the way we think, not by chaining our bodies so that they can't commit the acts, but by becoming a kind of person who doesn't want to commit the act to begin with. That's the whole point. That is New Covenant law keeping. And you can't get around it. It is not killing somebody. It is loving them and doing them good. And wanting to do so. And so Jesus' point is not an ill-fated attempt to make the world a better place, but to make his kingdom flourish as it exists in a world of sin. As we're surrounded by sin, we have given our hearts to Christ and live differently. Now first, let's define lust in this context. Jesus isn't prohibiting physical attraction or the recognition of that. He isn't saying that if you happen to notice that someone of the opposite sex is attractive, you've committed adultery or you've sinned in some way. Because we're going to see in a moment, adultery is speaking to specifically married people, but we know that unmarried people can commit the same sin, so we're going to make the same application. But he's not saying that, you know, Well, that person, that's a beautiful woman. You recognize that. Well, you've sinned. You've lusted in your heart. That's not what he's saying. And I might add that there is a difference in dressing in an attractive way and dressing in a suggestive way. I think some have taken all this and you can run off to extremes. So you've got, for instance, some Muslim nations that cover their women from head to toe in a potato sack as if it's wrong for any other man to see their wife or to recognize that she might be attractive. No doubt all that can be abused. And you can go the other way, and it's unbelievable to me that a Christian man can want his wife to dress in a way that draws attention to her body in some way. And so you can kind of go too far in either way in this. But at the same time, God has made people pretty and beautiful and attractive. Not all to the same degree, but that is there. Hanging sacks over the heads and bodies of women doesn't fix the problem of lust and adultery. It might help it to some degree, but that's not we're getting back to Christ's point here. You can do those things, but that's really not addressing the heart issue, right? And so Muslim men, no doubt, who live in those countries and situations, have the same problems as men all over the world. Because Christ doesn't control their mind. So you can live in complete darkness so you can't see anything. It's not going to change anything. Now, it would be great if there were biblical laws, as there used to be, on decency in our country. It would be helpful. It would help. But, of course, again, that might benefit society, but it's not going to stop lust. And for us who are concerned about a heart and the root of sin, we know that we need more than that, right? And that's what Christ is going to get to. Obviously, modesty only makes sense to anyone who wants to maintain godliness, because immodesty is complicit with lust. It encourages it. And while the Bible has some things to say about dressing modestly, I believe the reason it doesn't have a lot to say about something like this is because mankind has always battled this. It should be obvious to everybody what happens when you dress a certain way or when you think a certain way. And so I don't think the Bible has to go into a whole lot of things about how we dress, because it should be obvious. And at least that's my take on that. But it does do it, because we do need some direction always, of course. But the lost dress provocatively because they want to be lusted after. I mean, that's no secret. It's only a naive Christian man or woman who thinks that they should be able to dress immodestly and that that's not provocative. I know people, Christians, who think, well, bathing suits, one piece or two pieces, are okay as long as you're at the pool or at the beach. Now, they would say, well, it's inappropriate at church. You wouldn't do it at church, but it's okay over there. Now, I'm going to give you my thoughts on that. I think it's a lot of hogwash. I don't think men stop lusting when they're on the beach. I think that is probably where they would find it more. So I think that's just a complete nonsense way of thinking, but, you know, it is what it is. Christians and cultures have always had some differences on what constitutes immodesty. I understand that, but it's lust is a sin, so anything that encourages that, you know, is what it is, right? And so I believe the Bible assumes this, and so why it tends to remind us that we need to dress properly, it doesn't have to go into a lot of great detail. But those are some of that stuff is things that we have to leave to Christian freedom and do the best we can. But I'm going to preach to you what I think is important, and I think I'll just, you know, point you to the culture around us and say, okay, you know, you want to argue with me about dressing immodestly, look what has happened in our society when almost all restraint has been cast off. And I rest my case. But anyway, so, you know, you don't want to, why would you want to wear something low cut to a point that, you know, you're drawing attention to yourself and have men catch a glimpse and encourage them in these things? I don't understand why you'd want to do that. Now, again, I'm not saying you have to wear something up to your chin and all that kind of stuff, but I'm just saying a Christian love requires us to think through why we do what we do. And I think there's accountability there. And in this vein, we should always be careful that as we interact with each other, we always have Christ's mind, Christ's work in our mind, because it's not just about the way we dress, but the way we act. So that's why sometimes you have all these relationships, romances that come about in the workplace. Because when you work side by side with someone, day after day, hour after hour, it's very easy to develop relationships that go beyond what is proper. So it's a very similar thing. And it always goes back to the same thing. It is, you know, having a mindset that refuses to do that. There have been times, and I'll give you another example, there's been times in the 5 years I've been here where I have texted some of the women in the church for various things that are going on, questions I might have or whatever. But I have never had a online relationship with any woman. I don't have a ongoing textual relationship, for instance, with anybody. Because there's no reason. It's inappropriate. Because it leads to the idea of starting to have a relationship with another woman and, where you should be focusing on your relationship with your spouse, right? And I think that would be an example of where you have to stop and you've got to think, this is just something we cannot do. But again, within reason, where it doesn't mean I can't ever talk to another married woman or another woman at all or anything like that. You know, then we get to be, I think we start to show really our spiritual weakness. In other words, if I can't talk to another woman without lust or without being inappropriate, then I've got a real problem that needs to be addressed. And so lust, we could maybe boil it all down to an inappropriate relationship in a lot of different areas. And I think that's what we want to get the heart of here in Jesus, what he's saying in this sermon. Why you get up in the morning is going to determine what you do the rest of the day. And so a man or a woman who gets up in the morning wanting people to think that they are hot, for instance, in all likelihood, is going to go off the rails immediately, right? By what they put on, by their makeup, or how they act towards other people and so forth. They will continue to sin in how they interact, speaking to others in ways that are inappropriate. But we also must understand that we live in a time in which you are going to see a lot of inappropriate things out there. In other words, you know, we can only be concerned with our own families, our own church or whatever, but it's out there. And so if we haven't figured out how we're going to deal with that, if we haven't prepared our hearts, then it doesn't matter how you dress in that sense. Now, let me just give you in a nutshell how I think at least the main way you've got to deal with what you see and how you control your minds. This goes for men and women, but, you know, men are usually the ones who really struggle probably in some ways. In a nutshell, if you have to think of people as souls who need Christ, as brothers and sisters in Christ, as people you are to minister to, you're to see people creating the image of God, you cannot see somebody as an object. Because as soon as you look at somebody and they are become an object to you, lust is going to come in some way or some sort of inappropriate thought because you don't see them as someone, a human being in the made in the image of God, as someone that you need to minister to. And so as my goal, as a pastor, and I think it should be for any man in the church, I look at the women in our church not as objects, not just as women, not just at how pretty they are, all that kind of stuff. These are people we are to minister to. People who need the Lord, who need to grow in the Lord, who need help, who need to be ministered to, just as I need to be ministered to. And so that it begins there. And so with all this in mind, then I think we can see what lust is in this passage. It isn't realizing that a woman is pretty. Otherwise, and this is no one to get married. If you couldn't even do that, right? Even God's word at times points out when someone, as the KJV says, is fair to look upon, right? Is beautiful. No one in our culture gets married on purely platonic grounds. You know, you don't say, I think you'll make a good wife. Let's marry each other, even though we find each other repulsive. You know, no, you don't do that. So there's nothing wrong with understanding that and acknowledging that. It is instead to see someone as merely an object of your desire, and want to fulfill that desire regardless of God's will or the harm it does, because it always does harm too. Because again, if I am thinking of somebody as an object, then you can bet I'm really not ministering to her. I'm not concerned about her spiritual condition. I'm only concerned about how she pleases me. So it's a form of hatred. See, that's why these things go hand in hand. So it's to think inappropriately about another person, and if married, wanting to be unfaithful to your spouse, because the unmarried person can lust, and it would be inappropriate, and you could have inappropriate relationships. But as we're going to see here in a moment, adultery takes it to a whole nother level. Because now it's not just you and that woman. You have broken your covenant vows with your wife. And so you're acting out hatred against two people. And we'll look at that, because Jesus here, I think, is making that point. So it might be a good time to point out that Jesus here really is speaking primarily to the married, at least in a specific way, because he says lust and adultery. And adultery is something that only a married person can commit. And so we can apply this to everybody, obviously, but Jesus here is speaking specifically to the one who could commit adultery, which would be a married person. And the reason he's doing that is because, as we'll see when we get the next couple of verses, he's laying the grounds to attack their whole understanding of marriage and divorce. And that's just where all this is leading. So I think right now he's concerned about how the leaders view, these Jewish leaders viewed marriage and divorce. And that's where he's getting to that. Now, it's one thing for an unmarried person to see someone as attractive and think that this might be someone that I would like to marry. But a married person can't do that. And you might see someone as attractive, but that's it. But it could go no further, right? Because only your spouse is available to you. There's nobody else. So anything beyond that is a form of lust, certainly inappropriate. And again, a form of adultery, as Jesus says here. You might see someone as attractive, but that has to be the end of it, because anything beyond that is lust. And so, as Jesus is going to teach us, it must be dealt with harshly or you're headed for trouble, because you're putting your marriage in jeopardy. Now, I make this distinction because I think the Bible makes this distinction, and we won't go too much further here. Jesus is not talking about sexual immorality in a general sense. I have made some application in that way, because lust is lust. But here he's talking about adultery, which is a sin that is committed by a married person who engages in an illicit intimate relationship outside of that marriage. And so adultery is a very specific sin that only married people can make. And they say, well, what do you mean? 1 Corinthians 6:9. Or do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived, neither the sexual immoral, which is one word, nor idolaters, nor adulterers. See, he doesn't lump it all together, because there's some differences there. Doesn't mean that one is less of a sin or something like that, but there are differences. When you look at the sexual sins listed in Deuteronomy, for instance, in chapter 22, this is just an example. If a married man is illicitly involved with a married woman, they are both stoned. The penalty for that was death, right? And that's the end of it. Adultery was, pun intended, a grave sin that required capital punishment. And so that, again, say, well, we're not under that law. Well, no, of course, that is repeated in the New Testament, obviously, but we're not under the penalty of that law today as a society, maybe. But we do see how God looks at it. He thought it was a sin that required capital punishment, so that immediately helps us understand how he views all this. But in the same chapter, in Deuteronomy 22, and there's a lot of other laws that we can't get into, so this isn't all that the Bible says about this, but it's just an example. It says that a woman who is a virgin, unmarried, who is not engaged, because if you're engaged, you're considered basically married. It says that if a man forcibly takes her, that man is to pay a dowry to the father. If the father is okay with that, then he must marry her. He can never divorce her. And so we say, in our culture, in our way of thinking, we'd say, wait just a minute. That doesn't seem fair. You've got basically doing the exact same thing. The unmarried man gets his wrist slapped. The married man is stoned to death, right? And the woman too. That's not fair. Well, again, we can get into all the ifs, ands about it. But the reason is because it's different. It's a different sin. There's a way to, as bad as that was, it was a way to make that right where they could be married. But when you commit adultery, you have broken that relationship, and God says that is a worse sin. That destroys a marriage. That destroys a family. So it's interesting that the Bible, that God sees that as different. And again, it's not to downplay immorality among young people or unmarried people. That's awful. But it's setting marriage up a little bit higher, and it's saying, look, This has got to be taken in a very much more serious way. This we're taking it all to a whole new level here in how we act. I think it's very interesting there. Unmarried persons absolutely are not to engage in sexual immorality before marriage. Period. There's no debate about that. The Lord, the Bible couldn't be any clearer about that. They are capable of lust because obviously lust would take place before that. As 1 Corinthians points out, they all end up in hell if they're not saved. But Jesus is setting up what leads to unbiblical divorce, especially among these self-righteous Pharisees who think that they are getting away with something when they divorce their wives unbiblically. And they do that because they're lusting after other women to start with. And that's something we have to save until we get to that in a couple of weeks. So this passage is specifically about marriage and lust, even though it obviously has other ways to apply it. But let's be clear that it can cover any area of in our life in which our thoughts are concentrated on self with no regards to God or others, because that's what all these sins, that's the sin, the beginning of all other sins. It is, I will do what I want to do. Not what pleases the Lord or not what helps that other person. And so lust especially becomes damaging when it is allowed to control our goals and our actions. And again, think covet too, is when it says thou shalt not covet. Because that's a form of lust. It is, I'm not content with what the Lord has given me. I see something out there I want. And so I want to get it no matter what. And the sin is that you're not content with Christ. You're not content with what He's given you to begin with. And so Jesus reminds us that, like murder, wanting to have what is not yours, not being content with what God has given you, wanting to live in such a way in which your desires are paramount, is the same sin against God as acting those thoughts out. So it's just as bad to be discontented because your car is not quite as nice as your neighbor's as it is as if you steal your neighbor's car, for instance. And that's something for us to think about. And it gives, it focuses on what we need to work on, loving Christ and being okay with whatever comes your way. And so one thing Jesus' teaching reaffirms is that we are not animals. No doubt part of what has led to our sexual freedom today is because so many have bought into the idea of evolution, that there's no God, or that some, at some level, we're just evolved animals. And in such a mindset, sex is nothing but us being natural, being what we are. It's a biological function. And monogamy is a social construct that has begun by some religion, but it's unnatural because they think of themselves as animals. And many make that argument today. And that's just a natural man working out the suppression of the knowledge of God in his mind. He knows better, but he doesn't care. And so Jesus tells us men that when we interact with women, that we cannot think like one who has no understanding. You can't think about life purely on a physical plane. You cannot have the mindset that if it feels good, do it. We have been put here to bring all things into obedience to Christ. And I'll close with this verse then in 2 Corinthians 10. For though we walk in the flesh, we are not waging war according to the flesh. Now, again, it's an overstatement. It's meant to focus on one thing for a minute. We do wage war against the flesh. That's what Jesus is talking about here to some degree. But what Paul's saying is what Jesus is saying here. The war begins in the heart. I'm not going to get to this today, but this is where he leads to with the cutting off of your hand or poking out your eye if it offends you. That's trying to deal with the problem in the flesh, with the flesh. And Paul here is saying, no, you have to deal with the problem in the heart. So he said, for the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. We destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God and take every thought captive to obey Christ, being ready to punish every disobedience when your disobedience is complete. So it is to get your mind and your heart set to love Christ as you should, to be able to think through things before you act, that when you stop to think about something, you're able to compare it to what the Bible teaches, to bring the love of God into it and to make the right decision. You don't stop lust by poking out your eyes. And I'll leave you there because that kind of opens up a whole nother thing that we need to think about, because it gets at the heart of obeying the Lord and being conformed to Christ and winning the battle over these things. But I'll have to save that for another time. Any questions? All right. I hope you have a good week. You're dismissed.